So, good morning, everyone. It's a real honor for me to be here. And, you know, it's quite a soup to nuts background for me, but the fundamental thread through all of it is that I've taken care of families, not specifically individuals, but families my entire career. And while I've broken those sections apart a bit, everyone all comes back together in their tribe. So I sort of think of it as a version of tribal medicine, and I take care of mothers, I take care of the people that they have relationships with, and I take care of couples. And when we look at women's medicine and family medicine, you have to look at it in a relational construct, because women are often heads of families, and they certainly are mothers, and women's decisions about everything has to do with their relational attachments. So when we look at it from an integrative health perspective, and you think about women's health and families' health, this is relational health. And what I'm going to talk about today has everything to do with maintaining good relational health. How do you do that? What's its meaning and significance? So I just want to tell you that I am not a scientist, and like Dr. Noritz, I spent an enormous amount of time going over the endocrine system in school and continue to do so. I was so relieved to hear somebody else in medicine does that. But the research that I'm going to bring to you today in a very lay audience form for all of our benefits is coming out of all kinds of universities in Spain, the UK, Turkey, Pakistan, Scripps College, San Diego State University of Communications, University of Illinois at Urbana, the Touch Research Institute. Isn't that a fabulous place to work? The Touch Research Institute, which is at Mailman Center for Child Development and the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine, University of Berkeley, or California and Berkeley. These are fabulous scientists from a variety of disciplines who are looking at the medicinal value of touch. Why is touch so important? Why is it so meaningful for us? Now, I want you to take note of this first slide because, first of all, it's crossing generations. It's crossing genders, perhaps. We don't know the gender of this infant. It's certainly crossing race and ethnicity. And yet, it's abundantly clear, based on the expression of this gentleman's face, who clearly must be infirmed on some level because he's in bed, that he is getting an enormous amount of benefit from having this infant in his arms. And we often think of touch as something that we should receive only when we're sick, that somehow it's just through caretaking practices that touch makes a difference in our lives. And actually, for me, in some ways, this is how I was introduced to the concept of the healing powers of touch and the medicinal value of it. My father had polio when he was a child. And for those of you who aren't familiar with polio, it is alive and well still, not as much in the United States, although there are pockets of it in segregated communities like the Amish, for example, and the Hutterite community, but certainly across the world in third world places. And when there were these big polio outbreaks in the early 1900s and 20s and 30s, the stigmatization was extraordinary. So people who survived polio were very stigmatized, and this was years and years before the Americans with Disabilities Act ever existed. So I grew up with a parent who was stigmatized and also disabled, and it was apparent that he was. However, what was extraordinary about my dad's story was that he recovered as much as he did from polio, and he just used a shoe with a lift in it. He had one leg that was atrophied, and he walked with a very apparent limp, but he was quite mobile and capable. But what was extraordinary was that my father was treated and his disease managed through something called the Sister Kenny Method. Does anybody in the office audience know what the Sister Kenny Method is? Have you ever heard of it? The Sister Kenny Method is extraordinary. It is a treatment that's touch-based. And she was a nurse who came from Australia. And, of course, this was the advent of the soaring application of allopathic Western medicine, and people said, oh, this is ridiculous, this doesn't work. But Sister Kenny's method was to massage the entire body 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, until the infection passed. And that meant reducing the impact of the atrophy from the infection. So, Sister Kenny, there's actually a hospital in Minnesota that is called the Sister Kenny Unit. That's where she was from. That's where my father's immigrant family landed when they came from the Czech Republic. So my father was an example of how touch works, how it's pain relieving, what its medicinal benefits are. Then you take that and you marry it, literally, to my Greek mother. Now, I don't know how much any of you know about Greeks, but we are the ultimate hedonists, and we touch people constantly. We can't communicate with people without putting our hands on them. And we also communicate in very loud voices, and we have big meals because you need more calories in order to do both of those things on a regular basis. You can't possibly be touching people and yelling your political opinions and telling people how much you love them unless you eat a lot. So this is the environment that I grew up in. People were touching, they were yelling, they were eating 2.5 hours, 3 hours at a time at the table. And my father was living proof of how beneficial touch was, and it made all the difference in his life. And he had a big family, as immigrant families often are, lived in an immigrant community with other related immigrants from their town in the Czech Republic. And so people took turns. And for 24 hours a day, for probably 4 or 5 days, my toddler father was massaged constantly. And the atrophy that remained was insignificant, relatively, to what polio could do. Then, as I grew up in this hedonistic environment with pets and food and a lot of noise and a lot of touching, I ended up becoming a midwife, and, you know, people often learn through stories. I certainly do. I'm an auditory learner, and the story that my mother tells about why I became a midwife was that I had gone to camp, and I went to a farm camp, a day camp, and I had seen a calf born that day at camp, and I came home, and I told my mother, and of course my mother, thinking that what was the best part, I would say, oh, the calf. And I said to her, the placenta. And my mother thought, what sort of child have I given birth to? I was 5, but it fascinated me, and they still do. So anyway, I became a midwife, then, of course, got involved in maternal child health and family health, and went on to be a sexuality counselor because there was so much heartache attached to it. And I am a very big supporter of marriages. I think marriages are incredibly beneficial institutions. They help people financially, emotionally, spiritually. And the crises that I was seeing in people's intimate life is what led me to go on and further my education. So the next slide I'm going to show you is that, you know, our relationship to pleasures in general, touch included, is that we often look at them as indulgences or rewards. I can have that fabulous piece of pound cake because I worked so hard today. I wish I was so discerning. I ate the pound cake regardless. but this is what we do with pleasure. I can take a bike ride. I can go for a massage because I worked so hard and I did all of these things. We don't look at pleasure and its medicine factor. And what I'm going to be talking about today is that this is an intervention that's available to all of you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and it has the lowest side effects profile of any intervention, any clinical trial that you may engage in. And none of you have to be scientists to do it. So we have taste, of course, we have smell, hearing, seeing, but touch, above and beyond all other things, is one of the most important. It's certainly one of the most medicinal. And it's also the sense that is first activated. Touch is what we learn first and foremost. We're not tasting things. We may hear things, but, you know, there's a lot of debate about this as to how much fetuses hear in utero. We certainly aren't looking at things. And fetal or newborn vision is 12 inches, approximately the distance from nipple to breast for nursing. Beyond that, babies can't focus very well. They certainly can see 12 inches, but it's touch. And you know, who are the greatest flirts of all? Because they're asking for touch. Infants. Infants are expert flirters. Think of it. This is what draws all of us into them. Is they coo and they smile and they chortle and they look at us straight in the eye and they never avert their gaze. So we respond to them by touching them. And they're doing this because it's a survival mechanism. Touch, skin is your primary route. And we know very little about skin. You know, in the world of sexuality counseling, people always say, oh, I know my brain is my most important organ. Oh, no, it isn't. It's your skin because it's the largest organ of your body. We don't really think of skin as being an organ or having organ-like properties, but it's our first barrier against infection, which is why you don't want it to break down. We need to protect it because it can be damaged by the exterior elements. It has all sorts of organic processes that keep us safe. There's bacteria that grows on our skin that never enters our lungs or any other part of our body because it has a defense mechanism. We don't respect it very much. And when we think about caring for our skin, we usually think about our face. You know, I want this cream, I want that cream. You know, my partner pointed out recently that I have developed a deep groove in my forehead. Oh, that's from so much wearing. Do you want to do something about that? No, I earned that groove. I've worried a lot in life. I like it. It's a little bit like a trench, and it's the only wrinkle I have on my face, but I am 54. I need to have some evidence. But our skin is incredibly interactive with the environment and with other people. And we don't credit it as such. It's an extraordinary organ. It weighs 6 to 10 pounds. So if I don't eat that piece of pound cake, maybe I could lose 2 pounds, but I'm not going to lose it in my skin. It's 20 square feet wide. So if you're trying to figure out, well, it's 6 to 10 pounds. Of course, this is size and age dependent, but what does that mean? Well, if you have a rectangle that's 5 feet by 4 feet, imagine. That's what covers your entire body. That's what keeps you safe, first, from all sorts of other things that can insult you and assault you. There are 4 layers, and each layer has a different function, and it has trillions of receptor sites. Trillions. These are receptor sites to pressure and heat and cold and pain and soothing. Skin is very receptive to soothing. And there are a lot of pain-relieving mechanisms that we can use through our skin and that we don't take advantage of. Now, the medicine of touch, well, the somatosensory cortex is a very primitive part of the brain. You're not going to remember this. However, if you know the word soma, and growing up in my household, I spoke Greek before English, and my father had to learn Greek because Greeks rule, and so that's just the way it goes. So he spoke Czech, he spoke Greek, he spoke English, or he tried to understand Greek. That was interesting as a child. We could get a lot of things off on him. But anyway, the soma means body. It's your flesh. So it's the sensing of the flesh. It's the somatosensory cortex. It's deep inside the middle of the brain. It can convey and sense positive and negative emotions. It's extraordinary. The experiments that they've done at UC Berkeley, what they've done is this scientist has had people put their arm, their bare forearm, in a box, and then they have someone who they can't see touching their skin, and the person is assigned a particular emotion, and don't you know, the person whose arm is in the box actually can tell you what they're trying to convey. Who would imagine? This scientist did this, Dr. Kelter. That's his first, Dockner is his first name. He was pretty sure this was the stupidest experiment he could ever come up with. Well, it wasn't. Actually, his data is extraordinary. It's impressive. Emotions are transferred through our skin. And if you think about it, when someone's angry with you, their touch is very different than when they're being soothing. It leads to a deeper sense of connection with others by increasing oxytocin. Now, if you look at the studies about oxytocin levels in the brain, you'll see across the board that oxytocin leads to improved health. It reduces cortisol, which is excreted by the adrenal glands. And cortisol is your stress hormone. And what happens is when you get flooded with cortisol, which all of us do, and certainly all of you in this room probably have higher levels of cortisol than most of us who are not dealing with some of the stressors that you have at home with children who are affected by Duchenne's, your cortisol is actually impairing your cognitive capability. Because when the cortisol rises, gets into your frontal lobe and your executive processing site, you can't think. It worsens depression. You get confused. You get agitated. So your impulse, I know, as loving parents and as loving grandparents and as clinicians, is to touch the child with Duchenne's. You have to touch one another. It's not just about touching these children, your children. It's about touching one another. And when we look at research on the relationship between clinicians and their patients, who do you suppose has better outcomes? It's not the brilliant scientist who has no concept of touching their patients. It's the clinician who puts their hands on the patient. You know, I had an interesting experience. Interesting is like euphemistic for bizarre, oh my God. And that's exactly what it was. It was a bizarre and oh my God event. I hike. I live out in the middle of nowhere in western Massachusetts. That's part of my medicine. And I hike quite a bit. And I met a neighbor who's a primatologist, if you can imagine. We have no chimps in the neighborhood, but, you know, now she came from Rwanda and she was studying with Jane Goodall, and she now teaches biology at our local community college, which is actually a wonderful college. Anyway, I was hiking with Jen, who is this little sprite of a thing. She hikes in a sport skirt. I mean, who hikes in a sport skirt unless they're this tiny little sprite? You know, I'm wearing big clothes. I'm a big person. So we're going down this small and slippery decline, and I fall, of course, because I have no natural grace, and I impale my forearm with a branch. I mean, you can't make these things up. I get up because I'm appalled and horrified and so embarrassed, and Jen says to me, "I think you have a stick in your arm." And I said, "Oh, don't be ridiculous. I don't have a stick in my arm." Well, I couldn't tell because I was bleeding so much. And if you ever try to look at the underside of your forearm, you can't really see a thing. Well, sure enough, in the emergency room, when they were doing Peace Corps-type surgery on me, there was a branch in my arm. Anyway, later that night, I had taken some pain medication I had never taken before, and I had a seizure. This is distressing to your partner when you're completely rigid with your arm in the turkey roasting pan because you're supposed to soak it with Epsom salts. I had a drain. I mean, it was a nightmare. And, you know, it's not like we live in a city. It takes a little while to get the ambulance there. So I'm not breathing. I'm rigid. She can't wake me up. Anyway, I get to the hospital for evaluation. I wasn't touched once. Not once by my new young doctor. So finally, I got up. I was getting dressed, and he said, "Are you going somewhere?" I said, "Yes, home. Something tells me I can manage this better than you are." It was amazing. I will never go back there again. And fortunately, my spouse is also a clinician, so between the two of us, well, I didn't have too much attention at that point because I had just had a seizure, but we figured it out. So when we touch patients as clinicians, it makes a difference in outcome. Why? Because it tells people we care for them. We're communicating with them through the number one organ that we use to relate to people in the world. And actually, it means we take more time. Because you have to think about whether or not you're going to touch somebody before you do and whether or not it's okay for them. And self-caressing, this is a soothing mechanism. We do this all day long, hundreds of times. We do this. I do this to try to stretch out this trench. I am massaging my lower back. I'm stretching my hip flexors. I don't know. I'm doing all kinds of things. I scratch. I take my rings off and rub my hand. Self-caressing does many of the same things that touch from others will do for us as well. Touch is a language, and it's best when it's learned early in life. I cannot emphasize this enough. You must start learning this language from infancy on. You must do this with children, with other people's infants. Touch them. That's what they want. It's what they need. It tells them what's going on in the world, and it makes it easier to do it later on in life. Much easier. You know, if I had to learn my Greek now at 54, it would be impossible. But I dream in Greek sometimes. I can switch over somewhat easily. I mean, I don't have very many people to speak Greek with. You know, it's not like the second language of the United States, except it's in all of our medical literature. So when I get stuck, I try to break it down into the Greek root. But I mean, seriously, I'm not talking medicine most of the time. So learn it early. Include it in your contact with people. It's a learned and spoken language by individuals and families. I cannot tell you how many families I work with who have family breakdown because people have not been touching one another. They don't touch each other. They only touch the infirmed or the involved or one person. Or if you see someone who came out of a family and a family value was not touch, they will extend that touch to their children, but not to their partner. I see it all the time. And then their partner is dying on the vine, desperate, hungry, starving for the communication that can only be related through our hands. And let me show you something you can do to your partner. Don't panic. This is a G-rated experience. This is something you can do to your partner that people never do. Women never do it. We do it to our children and we do it to our dogs. But we never, now you're really suspicious, but we never do it to our partner. Watch. It's a powerful, powerful gesture because you can look them in the eye and sometimes you don't have to say a thing. And when we talk about communication, we always think about language. That's girl stuff. This is an important thing to know. Women, when they're stressed, move up into their voices. When men are stressed, they move down into their bodies. Now, that can be problematic. That's the sexuality counselor part of the conversation. And I realize that. But we have to appreciate that conversation, verbalizing, articulating, is not the only way that you can communicate feeling to people. It absolutely isn't. You need to touch them. And it fosters emotional resilience. There's no question that the research is showing this, and it reflects health in couples. And the way that it reflects health in couples is if you see couples touching each other, or if you see a couple who touches their partner, one partner is touching the other and isn't touched back, it's a significant indicator of the status of their intimate life and of their overall emotional connection. It's a diagnostically significant tool that I use in my office. Can you imagine? You know, my body is a great diagnostic tool. So are my eyes. And what I can sense when I see how people respond to touch is very important. If one partner reaches out to the other and the other one is sitting there in the chair, tied up in a knot, we're going to have a lower success rate. I'll do my best. I'll pull out the pixie dust. I'll get the love potion number 9. I'll get the magic wand. I'll do whatever I need to do. But if that responsive gesture is not there, my job is going to be harder. Now, pleasure comes in many forms. Laughter also raises your oxytocin, which is the feel-good, visceral, vasculature, relaxation hormone of all. Oxytocin, it's very helpful. Eating, well, I told the guy in the grill yesterday, he made such a great omelet for me, I told him I would marry him. This morning I said to him, oh my God, I lost track of time, the wedding's off. he looked at me like I was some kind of nut, but I said, I'm not a nut, I'm just Greek. Okay, spending time with friends, this is incredibly important, having a network of support. All of you know this. Social isolation, living with someone with a serious chronic illness is absolutely deadly. It makes everything worse. And so does not laughing at it. I mean, you know, laughter can be a complicated thing, and it's definitely culturally specific. You know, not all cultures find the same things funny, and that includes the culture of medicine. I happen to be pretty irreverent, but you sort of have to be in medicine. But we don't laugh at things enough. We just don't, and it's a fabulous pleasure. We can read, or we can listen. As I said, I'm an auditory learner. I listen to books on tape. I find it deeply, deeply soothing. I have long drives in my car. I'm always listening to something, either continuing education material, murder mysteries, novels, watching movies. Movies take you out of your very own life. And it's different if you do it in a theater because it's big. And you get lost in the movie. It's a great relaxation. I mean, unless you're doing something, you know, scaring you half to death. I mean, you don't want to do that. And pets. Now, there's a woman here yesterday whose son was fabulous on the panel about encouraging independence. And the question was posed, to how many of the young men that were on the panel have service dogs? Well, this is an area that I find particularly under-tapped for its benefit. And this young man's mother went on to tell me that Greg, who is his service dog, named after Greg from the Brady Bunch, has been an incredible asset. And now that Greg is almost 11, he has a service man, which is this young man's father. Greg is in retirement. He doesn't want to do a lot of work. He's tired of picking things up, flicking light switches on and off. So he takes the elevator up because this man's young man's father takes him up in the elevator. I mean, Greg is a part of their family. And this young man, as I recall, said, he is my best friend. Pets, and the research on pets is, it's extraordinary what pets can do. And why is it? Because when you have a pet, this is what you do with your pet. You pet them. Hence the name. We don't always refer to pets as our animal companions. That's kind of, you know, laborious and lengthy. Oh, it's my pet. And we also call someone we love my pet. I mean, language is a powerful thing. What are some of the pleasures we can experience that don't have to do with touch, although they do, because you can't drink your coffee without your lips and your mouth? Coffee. You know, not to be offensive to anyone, but when I have morning coffee, it's a transubstantiation experience for me. It is deeply holy and sacred. Something happens to me when I have coffee, and I refuse to drink it in the car when I'm driving. Because then I can't even concentrate on it. And anyway, when it has a lid on it, how do I smell it? Smell is part of why it tastes so great. And I can't see it. Look at this beautiful design on this cup. This is a beautiful thing. Okay, and spending time with your pet. I mean, I swear this dog sat for this portrait. He must know of his overall importance in life. Reading. Yesterday, I picked up a copy of the New York Times. I walked over to Barnes & Noble. I sat on a bench near the water. It was delightful. Of course, I didn't have my reading glasses, so I sort of, you know, assumed what I was reading. But that's okay. I mean, I got the overall gist of it. I looked at the pictures. You know, the New York Times has some good captions. And the beauty of nature. Now, you know, I always say that people have spiritual crises when they lose two things. Think of it as a DNA strand. We're talking a lot about genetics at this conference. My DNA strand, when it comes to spiritual satisfaction and spiritual health, is two things: faith and optimism. Some of us are restored in faith-based communities, and more power to you. I love that. My cathedral is nature. My imam, rabbi, priest, is the natural forces in life. It comforts me. And as Ivy so eloquently said, and that was such a hard person to follow because that was a fabulous presentation. What's life about? It's about living it and doing the best we can. And life is always a crapshoot. We just have to be grateful for the days that we have and do the best that we can and be authentic in all that we do. And nature is pretty darn authentic. So when I feel despairing, I go out into the natural world, which is part of why I live in a town of 1,800 people in farming country. That's deliberate. That wasn't an accidental accidental purchase of my house. Pleasure. Take pleasure breaks throughout the day. You know, we often say, okay, now it's the end of the day. I've been working like a dog. I can sit down for 5 minutes. Ooh, don't live like that. It's not good for you. Pleasure falls on a continuum. I start my pleasurable life every single day with that transubstantiating experience of my coffee, made just the way I like it. And then periodically throughout the day, I have interludes, deliberate interludes, where I work on bringing up my oxytocin level because I know it's better for my mild high blood pressure, and I know it's better for my mood, and I know it's better for everything about me, my outlook on life. I go out and I make a point of talking to people and touching them. Now, part of this is being Greek. Part of it is because I'm from the Midwest. Midwesterners are the kind of people that bring you a casserole when you move in. I live in the Northeast. My neighbors wouldn't speak to me unless, you know, it was posthumously. But, you know, I make an effort to have this happen in my life. It's experienced on a continuum again. One pleasurable event is not going to equal the other, nor does it need to, in order for you to get the benefit from it. And if you're struggling with this, which many people do, you need to make a list and you need to keep it posted. Now, on your table, there's propaganda about the books that I've written. I also have an author's life, an extremely busy mind. I can't sit still, and so I do a lot of different things. But I've published these books through Hay House Publishers. The most recent one is the second one. The first one is about raising sexually healthy teen girls. The second one is for adult women. And I work with so many people who come in and say, I have no pleasure in my life. And I say, well, what do you enjoy? And they can't answer the question. And I say, look, and this is true for all of you, if you're struggling with something, which all of us do, writing it down on a piece of paper, not doing it in an email document, you have to have the experience go from your head, down your arms, into your hands, onto the paper. Use a pencil, use your favorite pen, keep a notebook, make a pleasure list. We all forget. And what happens is when you commit something to paper, you create a document. It's a document. You can go back to it and say, look, my script, my idea, I can't think of anything. I'm so tired. I'm so stressed. What should I do? Oh, yeah. Go out and pull weeds for 10 minutes. It's restorative. Plant your seeds, whatever you're going to do. And pleasure can help reduce cortisol. We've talked about this, but it also reduces heart rate, and it also improves pain. What a fabulous thing. It improves pain. And pleasure is a disciplined practice. This is not something that you just hear this lecture about and then you go, oh yeah, what a great idea. I never think about these things. And then you let go of it. It's a disciplined practice like eating well, like exercising, like cleaning your house. Well, that's probably not a good idea because some of us clean more than others. But brushing your teeth is a disciplined practice. So is enjoying pleasure. It is a disciplined practice, and you have to do it because it's an incredible health-supporting intervention, and it's free, and there is no side effects profile, and it is powerful. And if you come to me for healthcare, you are as likely to leave with a prescription for antibiotics, probiotics, and some kind of pleasurable task. I write it down for people on a prescription pad. This is my Marcus Welby approach to taking care of people. And anyone who's ever been taken care of by me also has my home number. Why? Because I don't use a cell phone. It's not pleasurable. I can't hear anything. Just call me at home. Say to me, I don't know what to do. Where are you in life? Okay, let me give you a suggestion. It's a little bit like the pleasure hotline. This is what I struggle with all the time, and it's the quote in my newest book. If the world were merely seductive, that would be easy. If it was merely challenging, that would be no problem. But I arise in the morning torn between a desire to improve the world and a desire to enjoy the world. That makes it hard to plan the day. I struggle with this every day. And if you don't recognize E.B. White as the author of that quote, think of Charlotte's Web. E.B. White was an extraordinary man. Charlotte's Web was one of many wonderful books that he wrote. He was an extreme introvert. I don't know if people know this about E.B. White. He struggled with depression. Oh, the things that come out of an unquiet mind. And this was how he felt, nonetheless. He lived a long and very productive and very pleasurable life in some ways. These are words of wisdom. And I know that what happens to most of us is that we fall into the side of improving the world. And we certainly want to do that for our children, and especially our children that are struggling with Duchenne's. But as a mother, I, and also as someone who lives with a chronic disease that could have a very high lethality rate, but has been gratefully in remission for 11 years, I say that part of why this works for me is because I live a life full of pleasure. I take my ethnic roots seriously. I'm going to be the best, most accomplished hedonist I've ever met. And it is very powerful, and we undervalue it, we underestimate it, and we throw ourselves into problem-solving skills, trying to perfect them, when really there is no such a thing. So I hope this has been helpful to you. One of the things about the propaganda in front of you is that if you do order my work, there's a contribution associated to this organization if you do it through Amazon, or as I say, the almighty Amazon. And thank you for having me here. This is a real pleasure for me.